The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and the People's Podcast is here with the return of one of my favorite guests, Megadeth frontman, guitar legend, Dave Mustaine, will be here returning to Talk is Jericho. Actually, I took a road trip all the way out to Seal Beach, California, to meet up with Dave at the brand new Affliction Studios, run by my good friend Jose Mangan of SiriusXM. He has opened up this really wicked, cool Affliction clothing store slash DJ area slash studio slash home of the Megadeth Dystopia album release party. Very, very cool setup there down in Seal Beach, California. Great place for bands to hang out and perform. Jose's got this place all tricked out. It's going to be a cool, cool destination venue. It's in between Los Angeles and Anaheim. Very, very, very great work from my good friend Jose. So you got to check that out. They got a pool table. They got beers. They got affliction gear. But Dave and I were drinking some Megadeth wine, as a matter of fact, Blood of Heroes. You'll hear all about how to make wine from Dave. Dave is also going to play a little fact or fiction with me. Fact or fiction, Pantera's Dimebag Darrell and Vinnie Paul were almost in Megadeth. True or false? You'll find out. There will be more Big Four shows. True or false? You'll find out. Here's another one. Slash was at one point going to be the second guitar player in Megadeth. Fact or fiction? Dave will answer all of these legendary rumors or truths. He's going to talk about the Big Four. He's going to talk about making Dystopia, about new guitar player Kiko Loureiro. We're going to talk about Glenn Campbell, Alzheimer's. So many amazing, interesting. You can't talk to Dave Mustaine and not have an interesting conversation. So check it out. It's coming up. And if you haven't subscribed to Talk is Jericho yet on iTunes, this conversation with Mr. Dave Mustaine should be enough to convince you. If you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode. You'll never have to remember to go download or stream it. Talk is Jericho will be waiting for you every Wednesday and Friday morning like clockwork on your device, automatically delivered. Doesn't get any easier than that, so go do it. And while you're subscribing on iTunes, take a minute and leave us a 5-star rating and comment. I love your feedback. I need your feedback. It helps with the sponsorships and the viewerships and the credibility and the expansiveness. We want to get this show to expand. And if you subscribe and leave a 5-star rating, you can help out Talk is Jericho. All right. It's been a big week. My return to the WWE in a wrestling capacity in the Royal Rumble. You can call me the 51-minute man. That's right. I was in the Rumble for 51 minutes. It's pretty crazy when you think about it. And it's an interesting kind of psychology when you're in the ring for that long. And I know sometimes people think, oh, you're just sitting in the corner for the whole time. Well, the Royal Rumble is based around spotlights. When someone comes in, they get a spotlight. When certain angles happen, there's a spotlight. When there's certain eliminations that happen, there's a spotlight on that. So a lot of times if you see somebody sitting in the corner doing the typical punch, kick, you know, choke someone with your foot, it's because you're basically just staying out of the way. And when you do that, you're kind of a background performer. Now, if someone's watching you the whole time, it's going to look like, oh, he's just sitting down doing nothing. But that's kind of the concept of what you're doing. And then when it's time for your spotlight, you get back in there again. So to be, I think this is the third Rumble that I've been in for like 45 minutes or longer. I think in 2003, I was in there for a long time. In 2013, I was in there. But this is my longest Rumble appearance, which is a great spotlight. And it was really cool. I mean, the elimination of Kofi Kingston was hilarious. If you saw that in the replay, I drop-kicked him from the second rope and hit him in the face when he was eating a bag of popcorn while he was sitting on Big E's shoulders. And the popcorn went everywhere. And, of course, the confrontation with Triple H and the confrontation with Ambrose and all the stuff that we did towards the end. But I think the big buzz of the night and one of the big, huge surprises was the debut of AJ Styles in the WWE, which was a huge, huge get for us. We've been waiting to have him for a long time, one of the hottest free agents in the world today, finally in the WWE. And it was really cool because the first night in the Rumble, I came to the ring, and him and Reigns were the only ones in there. All three of us just kind of stood there, and there was a really good buzz. had a cool little high spot. AJ popped me, had some nice blood coming out of my nose, which is always cool and get really into it when you get a little bleeding happening. And then, of course, we worked the next night on Raw, which was another surprise. And when it was pitched to me, it was pitched to me one way, and then I had an idea to kind of go another way. So hopefully, if things keep going the way that we hope, you might see another Jericho Styles match. So we'll see. But definitely great performer. And it's always hard. You come into the WWE. I mean, he's the New Japan world champion, you know, and then also Ring of Honor. Like, you know, he's known as one of the best performers in the entire planet. But when you come into the WWE, you're basically starting from scratch. And I know you guys know that. We've talked about this before. And also a lot of people might have seen him around, but a lot of people might not know him at all. So when he comes in the dressing room, I felt a little bit, not bad for him, but I understood what he was going through, because he shows up there when we're having the meeting for the Royal Rumble, because he was probably hiding all day or whatever it was. And he comes into the meeting and he knows some people, but he's standing in the back and kind of being quiet and doesn't want to step on anybody's toes. But he's going to do great in the WWE. It just takes a month or two of just acclimating to the different way that we do things, which is different from New Japan, which is different from Ring of Honor, which is different from TNA. And as far as character and interview skills and all that sort of stuff, he's going to hone in on all of those things in actual matches themselves. So, and a little known fact is that the two of us have never stepped in the ring before. We have never locked up. In the Rumble was the first time, and then the match we had on Raw was the first time we'd ever had a singles match. So I was actually really happy with it. It was fun. It was a lot of fun to get in there with a new guy and kind of suss each other out a bit. And now it can only, you know, it'll only get bigger and more intense as we go forward. So I think it was a really cool debut. I think the Royal Rumble this year was tremendous. The actual Royal Rumble itself, that match, they're always so much fun because there's so many different elements and things going on, and you know, spotlights like I mentioned earlier, and R-Truth with the ladder, and Brock Lesnar, you know, just destroying the Wyatt family, but then getting thrown out, and then, you know, everything kind of fits together in a certain way. And as we start the road to WrestleMania, who's going to be wrestling who? You know, what programs are there going to be? And you can start to kind of suss it out. You can start to kind of see it and figure out, okay, well, these guys will probably be working together. Are these guys going to be working together? It's an exciting time of year. You know, it's January all the way through to April when you get that real cool feeling. It's like the playoffs are starting now, you know? The WWE playoffs are starting, and who's going to make it to the final, and who's going to be eliminated. And he, like I said, there's always so many surprises and cool things happening. Monday Night Raw, Jericho versus AJ, first time ever. And then The Rock comes back and talks for like 25 minutes, which nobody else could do. Nobody else could get away with it, but that's The Rock. It's just a really exciting time, and I'm glad that I'm back in the WWE right now, and I'm happy that AJ Styles is here. He's got great timing. He's got great offense that's a little bit different. He's very crisp, obviously, from having that Japanese style behind him. But like I said, it's just a matter of learning. You got to learn everywhere you go what exactly is it that you want to do and that you want to try and do within the company that you're in. And WWE is different from every other company as far as the work style and as far as how we do things. And but like I always say too, once you get over, you'll always be able to figure out how to get over. So I have no doubt AJ Styles is going to be over big time in the WWE. He already is, just from his fans that he's got. But there's a lot of people that have never heard of AJ Styles and don't know who he is or what he brings to the table. And at the Royal Rumble, we let them know a little bit, and we'll let them know a little bit more on Raw. You know, I love people who are like, you know, Jericho said, welcome to the big leagues, kid. He's been in TNA. But listen, I agree. He's been all over the world. But the WWE is the big leagues. That's the truth. It's not being arrogant or being dismissive of his past, but the WWE is the big league. It's where everybody wants to be if you're in the wrestling business. And I don't care what you say. Everybody wants to be in the WWE because this is the big leagues. This is the big time, the biggest pro wrestling company in the world ever, in front of the biggest stages, the biggest crowds, the most worldwide influence. You go from being a worldwide, hot, free agent, independent star, and in two nights, more people know who AJ Styles is right now than they did for the entire 15 years of his career up to it. So that's not demeaning. That's just the truth. And if you don't like it, then you're just living in dreamland, because nothing beats being in the WWE. Okay. So I'm excited to have AJ Styles. I'm excited that WrestleMania is coming up. I'm excited to see what all the storylines go and all the surprises that are about to take place. So hold on to your hats. The roller coaster ride's about to begin. This is the big time. And I'm also excited on having my old friend Dave Mustaine. Such a great interview. Great, great interview. Always such an intelligent guy, very sarcastic, and just an amazing guitar player and songwriter. The new Megadeth record, Dystopia, if you haven't heard it yet and you like Megadeth, you like rock and roll, check it out. I was talking to Slash about it. I said it's maximum riffage. And he's like, riffage Maximus. And he's like, absolutely, that's Megadeth for you. These riffs are harder and heavier than ever. And Dave is amazing today. He's coming back to talk his Jericho. But first, one of the reasons why I'm able to have him on this show is because of my great sponsors, including DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. All right, if you haven't downloaded DDP Yoga Now app, you need to. This is the perfect time. I got the DDP Yoga app on my phone. I've been doing my DDP Yoga workouts right from my phone. I finally can put my old DVD player. It's not even old. I got a MacBook, and you can't even put DVDs in it anymore, so I had to buy this little DVD attachment. What a waste of time. It's like, why do I even have this thing? Like, get out of the 90s, Jericho. And DDP's helped me do that with this new app. I don't have to lug around the DVDs. All of the workouts are on the app. Plus, I get access to live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center. Very cool stuff. Very intense workouts that make me feel in better shape every single day. You guys know how much I believe in DDP Yoga. You know my DDP Yoga story and what Dallas did for me and my career. And that's why he's giving you guys such a great deal on DDP Yoga. You go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and then you purchase the DDP Yoga workout for yourself. You also get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. That's 3 months. That is an amazing deal. 3 months for free. I said for free. You get access to the workouts. You get recipes. You get cooking shows. Tools to help you track your progress. You earn rewards throughout the app to redeem for cool prizes and DDP Yoga swag. That means the more workouts you do, the more points you get. You take those points, you redeem them for prizes. Who else is going to do that? Only DDP. Listen, if it's motivation you need to get started, then check out all of the amazingly inspirational videos that Dallas and his crew put together. You can see all of these transformation stories at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You won't believe the success story. So get started on DDP Yoga today. It's one of the best decisions you can make for your health, all right? Take advantage of this special offer. Get the lowest price for DDP Yoga and 3 free months of access to the DDP Yoga Now app by going to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Remember, over the last couple days, 51 minutes in the Royal Rumble, then 14 minutes the next night with AJ Styles. That's 65 minutes of wrestling, okay, in 2 days at 45 years old, all right? I'm in the best shape of my life. It's actually funny. Someone's like, Jericho's fat. He looks like he's pregnant. I'm like, geez, I'm the only fat guy in the world with a six-pack of abs. I'm looking at him right now. They look great, thanks to DDP Yoga. Only guy in the world that can do 65 minutes in a wrestling ring in 2 days, and that's all because of DDP Yoga, right? You are going to love this. You're going to love this app, but don't take my word for it. Read the incredible reviews it's getting on both iOS and Android. Don't miss out on the exclusive DDP Yoga offer at ddpyoga.com/Jericho for you sexy beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. You get the best price on DDP Yoga plus 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. It's going to change your life. Get started today. ddpyoga.com/Jericho.
Hey, podcast pal, here's a question for you. Where do you go to find Adam Carolla, Shaquille O'Neal, Steve Austin, Radiolab, Freakonomics, Heather Dubrow, Dan Patrick, and about 200 more of your favorite podcasts? Well, you go to Podcast One. That's where.
Seriously, right?
And you can grab our spiffy new Podcast One app today and have all of your faves right there at your fingertips. You can get this new Podcast One app at the App Store, Google Play, and, of course, PodcastOne.com.
So we're in the midst of this major giant affliction complex with our good friend Jose Mangan, hooked us up with Dave Mustaine, my old pal, my old chum. And it's a pretty cool time for you. Not only is it like NAMM time, which is super crazy, new album as well. So you're just going to have a crazy week with all the publicity and press and shaking hands and kissing babies that you have to do. Is that something that you enjoy doing?
Shaking babies and kissing hands?
Yeah.
Yes.
Shake them damn babies.
Yeah. This is actually really exciting for us. It's a great period for us. It's kind of like a renaissance, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a lineup change that brought in some new inspiration, and I think that just a lot of different changes. You know, we try and always, you know, take whatever's thrown at us and turn it into something good. You know, if not, you just might as well just curl up and die.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of those things, you know, we either looked at it like, okay, well, we're doing something wrong and this is, you know, the correct way to do it and recover and apply, or realize that we were doing it right in the first place and double down. So this is the time where, you know, you get into the last couple of moments before the record comes out. That's where most people peter out, you know, they give up, and we have been just relentless with telling people about the tracks and word of mouth, the whole grassroots movement. It's been really great.
Well, you have to do that nowadays, though. Mm-hmm. It's not like it was, you know, 20 years ago, where you just put the record out and sit back. Like, now you have to beat the bushes and hammer the pavement to get the word out there.
Well, you know, true that, but you also, if you wanted to have any longevity, 20 years ago, actually, a little bit more than that, was when Countdown came out. And I remember sitting in at the Tower, Capitol, mm-hmm. pounding phones, calling college radio. So it's just as much as you love your fans, how willing you are to go to any lengths to speak to them. You know, do you want to talk to a KXLU college station in L.A. here? Do you want to talk to, you know, a KNAC? Do you want to talk to a teeny little station or, you know, a fanzine or something like that? Or are you too big for that? Mm-hmm. I had learned to sing along time ago, I thought was brilliant. If you're too big to fly in coach, you're too small to fly in first class. So I thought, hey, you know what? That's great. Because, you know, I think a lot of us, we really remember where we come from, but sometimes success can really get you off that path. And it's funny, I was telling somebody this story the other day. I was in Spain, and Sharon had come up to me, and she goes, you know, Dave, there's only one person in the whole metal scene that was not salt of the earth like all of us. As I know exactly who you're talking about, but I'm going to pretend I don't know. So, and the truth of the matter is, you take away that little that variable in the equation, you know, we are working class. You know, we're like the Johnny Cashes of the metal scene. You know, what we do, you know, appealing to the blue-collared workers and stuff like that.
Well, I think it's something, too, especially with rock and roll, is that you never forget that you're a fan.
Mm.
We're all fans. Mm-hmm. And I think I never say no to press. Mm. You know, and if it's myself, I'll figure out a way to do it. If it's the band, I'll get someone else to do it. Because, like you said, if it's Johnny's basement college fanzine, hey, man, if I was 15 and I had my own fanzine and I got to talk to Dave Mustaine, I mean, that makes you not just a fan for life, but a soldier.
Right.
You'll go to
field marshal out there. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
You'll go to the wall for these guys that treated you with respect. Mm. And you're quite active on social media. I find social media is perfect for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I think you have these said field marshals that you're talking about out there reconnoitering the field and doing assessment of the battlefield. And just like Sun Tzu had said in The Art of War, sometimes you don't approach your enemy head on. You have to flank them. With the way that the industry's changed so much with peer-to-peer file transferring and you know, with pirating has always been an issue. You know, people will copy stuff, but I think because of the ease and comfort that people were able to duplicate stuff like that, we're kind of got out of control. But I think that when you look at now the way that the technology is, you really have to stay at the cutting edge with how you reach the audience. And it's not just by putting product in their pockets. You have to earn their loyalty by planting a seed inside of them. This is my band, and no one is going to take them away. They may have a bad song, they may even have a bad record, but no one will take away the place that band's, you know, earned in my heart. And that's probably the difference between people who have been doing this kind of music for 30 plus years and who have not.
Right. And you always get, like you mentioned, the longevity. Like, if you're a big Kiss fan, there was, you know, the Elder. And if you're a big Maiden fan, there was, you know, the X Factor, whatever it may be.
We all have them.
But you all have them, right. You can't hit 1,000% every time. It's just not.
Well, there's got to be the head of the snake and the tail of the snake. It can't all be the head, you know.
One way, how do you mean?
Well, one record has to be your best, and one has to be your worst. Right. I mean, you know, if anybody go, unless you were brought up in like one of those short bus school situations, you see the way that the little post goes up and the rings are different colors and they graduate and they get smaller as they go. Things have purpose and numbers and stuff like that. I wasn't insinuating you, by the way. I'm talking about, you know,
sure.
I wouldn't be that rude. The thing is
shut
that
up, Dave.
Know, our business is made up of a whole number system, and it's, you know, people say, well, there's no competition in music. The hell if there ain't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you tell that to the engineers that sit up all night long so that they can get the song done in time to get it turned in so that it can get released and try and get those BDS reports. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's so much behind the scenes that the average music listener doesn't realize. And our job has exponentially become much more difficult because we've had one of our income streams taken away. But if you're playing music because you love music, having that income stream taken away from you, you probably won't notice. And if you're living within your means, then and you are successful, that happiness is going to emanate from the inside out, and you know you're going to be happy with what you got, and fans are going to see that. You know, when you're, I was just saying something to somebody earlier today. A lot of bands, when they make a lineup change, that first record with the new lineup's great. It's the honeymoon. But then towards the end, you know, things sour. And that's how it is with just about anybody. And I think that when you're in a new relationship, especially musically, because musically is so passionate, that it that magic that you have when you're first together, the discovery of, you know, like a synchronized swimming or you know, like doing any kind of katas or wazas or, you know, sparring and stuff like that. You know, you have to count on your partner.
We have a team element, yeah.
You absolutely do, yeah.
Well, and it's there's a story behind this, so I'm going somewhere with this, but we're here on the West Coast, but you have a place here, but you also have moved to Nashville as well.
Right.
And we had a show in Nashville. We were playing with Theory of a Dead Man.
Mm.
And after the show was done, and someone was like, hey, Dave Mustaine is downstairs looking for you. I'm like, what? What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And I went downstairs, and you were hanging out in the dress room. You said, hey, I just wanted to come by and say hi. And I was mm-hmm. like, what are you doing here? And you're mm-hmm. like, yeah, I live in Nashville now. But it was like the most random, funny meeting. I'm like, why didn't you just tell me you're coming? Like, mm-hmm. I just wanted to come by and say hi.
Yeah.
But we were talking, and you said something very interesting to me. And this was before the lineup changed, before Sean and Chris left. You said, you know, there's no reason for me to write songs to try and get played on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did with Super Collider and a couple other records. It's not what we are. It's not who I am. I'm going to write something that's more what I want to do. Mm-hmm. It's more Megadeth. And I think that this record, Dystopia, you definitely did that. Was there a mindset for that? Is it just where you were in your career? Because it's some crazy great stuff. Seriously.
Thanks.
Thank I mean, you I very really, much. I'm not just like everyone's going to say that, but to me, this probably after 10 listens is my favorite Megadeth record since Rust
Thanks.
In Peace.
Thanks. Awesome. Well, you know, your opinion matters to me because, you know, we are friends. And,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
That does matter a lot to me. I think going into doing this record, there was so much stuff that was going on in my personal life. You know, I'm an emoter. I have always tried to put what I'm feeling or what I'm thinking into art form so that our fans can be educated by it. Our first records, we used lyrics that had words that you had to look them up. I always wanted to educate our fans so they would impart some kind of wisdom on the fans, enriching their word power somehow. And I think that
give me alchemy. I had to look up what's alchemy.
Yeah, like anisophobia and stuff like yeah. that. So, anyways, God, I completely got off the subject.
Sorry, yeah, you were talking about using bigger words on your earlier records.
So, anyways, the thing that motivated me the most on this record, I think, going back to your previous question, is like, you know, what is it? Is the drive that gets you there? You know, we had so many things that were going wrong at the time. You know, Pam's mother-in-law had Alzheimer's, and watching her die in front of us was a very long and very painful process. And then when she went missing and we couldn't find her for 2 months, and ultimately we found her, she'd fallen off of a cliff. That really challenged our family. And you had a management change, and you had another management change, and you had some stuff going on with our crew, and then Ellison had said something, and it got out to Sean and to Chris that the fans want the Rest in Peace lineup reunion, and those guys got hurt and quit, and everybody blamed me. And thank God Dave was man enough to say that, you know, it was my idea. I wanted the Rest in Peace reunion. And, you know, we gave it a good college try, too. It just wasn't meant to be.
Did you actually jam with those guys?
Played with Nick. We tried to do Rattlehead three times, and we couldn't get through the chorus, the first chorus. And he had had a physical injury to his arm, and he had told me about that, and I knew that he was having some problems with his playing ability because of what I'd seen online. So I was open-minded to it, and I thought, you know, the tour would be great. We'll do the tour, not the record. The record was always me looking at somebody who was going to be, you know, somebody who was going to keep the franchise going in the right trajectory and not necessarily going backwards, and certainly not for nostalgia and stepping downward to pursue some nostalgia. So we had talked about a couple drummers that were at the tip of the spear, so to speak, in drum land, and you know, everyone had their strong points and their weak points. My God, I played with Gar Samuelson and Vinnie Colaiuto, two of the greatest jazz drummers there are. So, you know, a rock drummer to me is something that's very elementary, not disrespectful or any way like that. So when it came down to looking at these drummers, I looked with a totally different set of eyes because I write drum parts to myself. I don't know how to play drums very well, but, you know, I had to play them a little bit. And so looking for a drummer was real simple. Adler was so simple to pick. And then getting Kiko was something that was a little bit harder because, you know, I look for three things in a musician. I look for attitude, ability, and appearance, you know, because, I mean, you know, you've got to have that whole
show business
package. You've got to be developed.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, to me, and first of all, to just want to mention something we said about Adler. Had you toured with Lamb of God?
Yeah.
So he was already on your radar. You'd watched him play and just said, this guy's
killer.
Yeah, we
did a giant tour with him, I think, in 06 or 05.
So he's the guy that you thought of, like, wow, it'd be great to have him involved in the
band. You know what? It didn't even dawn on me. Somebody had said something, and it was just like, that kind of a thing, you know, like, hey, because the obvious decision was Lombardo, but, you know, it's not going to.
Is that too much of a stunt casting, as they would
say? I think because, well, you know, there's several reasons why it should be Dave and why it should not. And I think that the shoulds were very legitimate and the should nots were equally as legitimate. So, you know, when you have to convince yourself somebody's right for the part, they're usually not. And it wasn't that Dave isn't a great drummer. He's one of the best.
I agree.
You know, he's one of the best there is.
I agree.
But we have a very staid, solid, repetitive pattern to the songs that are the same way, and the fans want them that way because of the articulation and the it's, you know, it's polyrhythms with the drum stuff. It's syncopated polyrhythms, and when the drums get off and the guitar's pedaling and riffing and jumping strings and stuff like that, and it gets off like that, it turns into a train wreck.
But the drums are locked in with your rhythms.
Then
it has to be.
Then it's fantastic.
It
sounds like, you know, an air raid.
But for Kiko Loureiro, like, I'm a huge Anger fan, and I have been since 1994. I discovered them when I was in Japan. And Angels Cry and Holy War and all of this lineage of great tunes. So when I heard that you got him, I think I might even text, like, dude, this is the guy. But it's almost, it's such a, like, a great choice, but just out of nowhere. How did he get on your radar?
You see, why I respect your opinion about our songs is because you are not just somebody who is in the entertainment world and the music world and just here by, you know, the credo of your other career.
Yeah.
You know, you really are a musician and you really do love what you do. And knowing Kiko, you know, I'd taken a picture with him for Burn Magazine 8 years ago and I forgot who he was. So he goes like, hey Dave, you know, we did a picture together 8 years ago for Burn Magazine. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, we're on the cover. And I was like, oh shit, I forgot. And I remember when it happened, I saw him and I was like, I don't want this kid on cover with me, man. I fight hard enough as it is to get covers. Yeah. You know, because I mean, that's the nature of the business. Yeah. There's only so many
and
covers.
That's the biggest rock magazine in Japan, Burn magazine.
Yeah, so they said they want him, and I figured, you know what, these guys aren't dummies. There's got to be a reason for him. And I talked to him a little bit, and I found him very engaging and very very nice guy to talk to. Mm-hmm. But did not leave an impression on me because I didn't think that I was going to ever cross paths with him again. So when the thing came down to the attitude, appearance, ability thing, we had a list of a whole bunch of people. I knew Chris was the guy, hired him to do the sessions. And you know, he's not in Megadeth. He's in Lamb of God. Mm-hmm. He's helping us. So just to make that clear. The thing with Kiko was, I looked at list after list after list, and these guys either had the ability and they would flop in the appearance, or, you know, they would have the appearance and they wouldn't have the ability. I remember I saw this one guy, and he was supposed to be the fastest guy in the world, or the fastest guy in America. And I listened to him play, and his playing was otherworldly. It was so magnificent. Mm-hmm. But he was covered in tats, and his hands had flames on his hands. And I thought, I'm so fast my hands burst into flames kind of thing. That joke would probably come out in the bust a couple times, and it would get old real quick. And I think that, you know, people would give him a hard time. I know our crew is very sarcastic, and so we tend to kind of go with people who are very unassuming and very dangerous. You know, it's the quiet ones you have to watch out for.
Yeah, the toughest guys in the room never brag about being tough.
Yeah, what do they say? Dogs with no teeth bark the loudest, right?
Yeah.
Sensei Benny taught me that one. So anyways, I saw a couple guys, they were great, and then I saw a couple guys, they were, you know, they almost got to the point where it was them, but there was something like one guy's too young or one guy lives away and he can't tour that much. And, you know, I mean, in order to get a tour bus with, you know, 7-8 guys, you know, and disappear for a month, that takes some chutzpah, because you've got to not only, one, tolerate people, but be tolerable yourself. You know, and then you've got to go up against that, the world out there. You know, it's you know, literally you and your group against the world, because Mother Nature has a wicked sense of humor, and stuff happens on the tour.
Yeah, so always.
Anyways, when the last thing that made me make my decision with Kiko was I saw this video, and he was playing guitar with another guitar player I knew that I respected, and just demolished him. And I was like, wow. It's the first thing I saw of him, because I didn't know his name. I clicked on the link, I saw him, and I was just like, that's the guy. Oh my God. And you know, like what you probably were saying, laughing a little bit, chuckling, knowing, you know me, you know my band, you know our music, and you know Kiko obviously way better at the time than I did when I hired him. So you knew how perfect the fit was, because he's passionate about what he does.
Well, and you can see that, and like I said, his pedigree is tremendous, because those records, great stuff.
Yeah.
But so, and you've been through this so many times before, when you say, okay, Kiko, we want you to have the job, what's the process? Do you guys go out for a drink? Do you hang out and go to the movies? Because you just said once something very, very important that a lot of people that aren't in bands won't understand. He's a great player. He fits in perfectly musically. You get on the bus and the guy, you know, he's a dick. And that's not going to last. Yeah. How do you suss that out? Or do you have to take a little bit of faith and take a chance?
Well, see, that's one of the problems that have happened with a couple of our alumni. There was the personal side where it kind of rubbed with other people in the organization, and you know, those things do happen. I think the thing with Kiko that made him probably so desirable was the ease and comfort at which I did audition him, because, you know, I had Broderick come down, knew he was a great player, spent a little time with him, and then just, you know, kind of said, okay, let's do this. But, you know, didn't really, like, sit down one-on-one and talk with the guy. We were building a gym at my house, of all things, you know. So with Kiko, he came out, and I sat down. We drove around. We talked one-on-one for hours. We went and had lunch, and was talking to him about Nashville and what I like and what I don't like, a little bit about the band and so on and so forth. And the phone rings at my house, and I said, I'll be right back. And he hasn't played a note yet. And I hear him pick up an acoustic and start playing with my other ear while I'm on the phone. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy's like Andre Segovia on steroids. Mm. Hang up the phone. I go back in there and I said, you know what? We got to do something like Eruption or like D or like Spanish Fly or something really brilliant. Yeah. It just showcases that Latin flair, because when Megadeth is played acoustically, it takes on a very Latin element that works for us acoustically. It's not like, you know, for lack of a better band, to say AC/DC acoustically would still have that rock boogie sound to it. Whereas with us, it takes on a different element and it works. So him coming in there was such a natural fit, the passion, the bends, the scales that he would do, the exotic note selection, stuff like that. And he's a hell of a nice guy too.
Mm-hmm. He's also, you mentioned Angra, they're from Brazil. Mm. They used a lot of like Brazilian percussion, a lot of piano.
Yeah.
Kiko's a great piano player. Mm. I mean, I'm assuming that probably most of the songs were written when you got them, but did he bring any of that kind of flair into what you're doing?
Not really. You know, we have talked about certain things to a degree. We did something on pledgemusic.com and there. You know, Kiko has a great sense of humor. He's very, very, very youthful at heart. And I was studying the console and looking at the Pro Tools rig and working on something really hard. It was me and him in the studio alone. Except for the cameraman. So he goes, hey, I've got this idea for a solo. He's like, okay. And he starts playing reggae. And I just went...
Sneer.
And I just looked at him like... I'm working. What are you doing? You know, and that's just him being playful, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that because he sensed that things were getting a little bit, you know, hyperbolic in there, and we needed to kind of
light
things up a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
As far as him contributing with the songwriting and stuff, I think he probably would have done more if asked, but. Due to the nature of our project, there's a requirement of how much music I need to write, which is boring as old people having sex, and your listeners don't want to hear about that. So I won't.
But old people having sex?
Yeah.
Please no.
But he did write as much as he wanted to, and I think that it's going to be great for us. You know, the Megadeth catalog has so many different twists and turns over the years where we've gone and how the band's expressed itself with songs that are a little bit more European in flair, a little bit more English in flair, a little bit more American in flair with the kind of a rock influence that it would have, but it still always stayed in that heavy metal, you know, the auspice. So I think this record really went back to, like what you were saying, back to like the new wave of British heavy metal, really hard, really riff-oriented, and Kiko's music is not something I'm really familiar with, but he picked it up like a, you know, like it was second nature to him playing.
So you don't go back and check out an Angra record and see you just watching him and going, this is all I need to hear.
I saw enough to know that that's all I wanted to see. As far as like bringing, you know, Brazilian music, stuff that's national or indigenous to where he's from. Like,
yeah, that will, yeah.
You know,
that's not going to fit.
I mean, if the dude was an Aussie, would I have a diggery doing the song? No.
That would be huge.
No,
and
yeah.
You could play it live.
Okay, right, whatever. But, you know, there are some really wonderful things with timings and that tribal thing where you do stuff where it's, you know, just not the normal time signatures, and you add something on a push or a pull or an upbeat or a downbeat or something that is in out of the norm of what a normal rock loop is, and that changes everything. You know, Max
Cavalera
uses this crazy instrument. I can't remember what it's called, but it's this God, what's it called? It's a crazy stringed instrument that he used in Sepultura, and it worked for that. I don't know. We may venture into doing that because we've used a lot of different stringed instruments. One of the things I loved about Led Zeppelin was when you listen to the songs completely, there was a color wheel there that just it was expansive. You could see all of the different depths on the horizon wherever you looked. Whatever the song was, you knew you were experiencing something sonically, but it had this 3D proportion. And a lot of other bands, they get into, you know, this whole colorization and with their music, and they don't experience explore anything. Mm-hmm. They don't have weird time signatures. Yeah. They don't have different guitar layerings. And we did that. I was listening to the master for Trust the other day when we were making some backup stuff. And, you know, we used a baritone guitar, we used a 12-string guitar, a normal guitar, we used so many different types of things. On that record, we also used a thing called a bouzouki, which is something that was on Insomnia, which is not one of those instruments that...
What is it?
It's kind of a Middle Eastern sounding thing made out of a gourd. And I got it from Marty for his birthday, and he liked it a lot. It's kind of one of those weird sounds at the beginning of Insomnia. And I think Insomnia kind of went way the wrong direction, and that's kind of where some of the skirmishes happened between myself and the production team at the time, because the directions were coming from... over yonder, so to speak, from Bud Prager and management to Capitol, telling Dan what to do, and you know, he was stuck between the dog and the fire hydrant. You know, he had to listen to them, and he was unable to really, you know, do what I wanted him to.
And what they were saying is to, for lack of a better term, make Megadeth more accessible.
Yes, exactly.
More
that's why they took. Well, they took the points off of the logo. They said for us to start growing facial hair, and you know, David,
you hate that.
The logo thing?
Facial hair. I've never seen.
I don't mind it, but you know, I'm not a really big bearded dude, you know. Mm. And David Ellison can't grow one. I don't think. I don't know that Kiko can. You know, Chris just cut his beard off. And you know, and unless we find somebody who you know really, really is digging on that whole beard thing, it never really has been in our camp. Mm-hmm. I don't mind. Anyways, I don't want to get off on a big facial hair thing.
Facial hair debate with Chris and Dave.
Bearded brothers will be boycotting our shows.
Done with Dave. Yeah, right. Just another thing to throw on the fire. Yeah. Another thing about being a guitar player in a two-guitar player band is chemistry, and I want to get into how you suss that out, Dave. But first, I mean, how about a little football chemistry? Like, how will Peyton Manning and tight end Owen Daniels, how will they get that magic chemistry on Super Bowl Sunday that they did last weekend? Will it continue? Will it be the kind of chemistry that can win you some cash in the process? Only one way to find out. Place a bet or two or three at BetDSI.com. It's the online sportsbook website that I use, and I use it because they're one of the originals and, quite frankly, one of the best. BetDSI has been around for over 16 years and have a solid reputation on payment of winnings. If your bet wins, you get the cash. There's no chicanery here. No sworn hoggery, all right? Or horn swaggery. Sworn hoggery, that's a good word. And BetDSI actually sets a lot of the lines that you're already playing on. BetDSI.com is quick and easy to use, too. It's idiot-proof, which is perfect for me. You can play on your desktop, laptop, your smartphone, and tablet. They got professional and novice action. And BetDSI is so trusted that a lot of professional players also do their betting there. You know you're playing with the pros now. If you go to BetDSI.com and set up an account right now, use the promo code 10TALK, that's the number 10, and the word talk with no spaces in between, you'll get $10 free. That's 10 bucks, man. 10 bucks is 10 bucks, as Geddy Lee once said. So get your Super Bowl bets in at BetDSI.com. Use the promo code 10TALK to get $10 free. And when the Super Bowl is over, you can use your winnings to bet on all major sports or even the upcoming elections, reality TV, or how about this? How about the Oscars? Bet on who's going to win the Oscars. That's an interesting concept. You can bet on just about anything and everything if you're looking for a place to play. Go to BetDSI.com now and use the promo code 10TALK. That's the number 10. And the word talk with no space in between and get $10 free. That's promo code 10TALK, 10 bucks free. Try betdsi.com right now. Stick with the originals, stick with the best.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha F335 acoustic guitar, just $99. Or get a Luna Soprano ukulele, only $49. Plus the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. Lessons for the beginner on your list. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.
Another question about being a guitar player, and your band is so obviously a two-guitar band, lots of harmonies, lots of trade-off solos and stuff. Is it I'm not going to use the word hard because probably nothing is hard for you guitar wise, but is it tricky to get that chemistry with somebody? Like you played with Broderick for 8 years or 5 years, and before that with Marty for 10 years. When someone new comes in, is it a little bit of a sussing out process to get that chemistry down?
Well, it's kind of like having a new. I'm not going to use that metaphor because there's no way I'll be able to pull that off. Someone will turn it around on me. So let me figure that. Having a new guitar player, trust me, if we weren't recording, I would tell you what it was.
I'm going to guess you're saying it's a new dick.
But No.
Got it. All right.
Close, but no.
Okay.
I think when you get a new guitar player in there, there's an excitement level because of the unknown, and there is the reward system when you guys start being able to synchronize stuff. It's very much like this thing,
patting your
where,
head,
where you can disassociate left, right, brain, and you can be able to. Take something that isn't in your wheelhouse and grasp it right away because, you're in the studio, the clock is ticking, and someone says, hey, try, juggling chainsaws right now real fast, Dave. And it's like, oh, okay, I'll get right on that. So when you have someone that has never played with somebody else, never even rehearsed, go right straight from Brazil to L.A. to Nashville, that's a pretty daunting task. Mm. I think that, you have to have a bit of a psychiatry and the way that you encourage people to just let them know. Because, as soon as you get out of your element and you're someplace away from home, you're going to be homesick. And every fiber inside of you is going to be crying to want to be home. You know that you have to be there to do your gig, but you don't want to be there. And you're struggling with these emotions. So to be able to have somebody who is clearly a fish out of water here know that this is going to be good for himself, his future. Don't worry about the outside world. Completely detach yourself from reality right now and let the gift God's given you flow freely through you. That's a tall order. If it's a guy you've been working with for a little while, you can say, hey, you know what, your wife's, she's on the rag again or something. The kids, they'll be okay. Just do the damn solo, okay,
yeah.
Would you? That kind
Dave,
of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when you have somebody new and you're experiencing stuff, and I think the great thing about that, too, is every time that you get a new relationship in your life, you have another opportunity to do things right.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, where I'm at in my life, I don't really have a lot of friends, and I have tons of acquaintances, but I look at it like, how friend versus like, I met some guy in the airport, and if I would say, hey, that guy's my friend, Willie Nelson.
Right, yeah, sure.
He's my friend.
Yeah. We took a picture together.
We're
friends.
Yeah.
But that's part of the thing. There's been some bonding there because I remember when the, was it the Pacquiao-Mayweather fight? For some reason, I text Kiko. I was like, hey, I'm over at Dave's. We're watching the fight right now. And I was like, yeah, tell Dave that,
I know what you said.
But you guys are hanging out and like, being buds.
Yeah, I think that's the way it is with all of us right now. We're really enjoying just having that friendship and playing. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like that new car thing, smells good, rides better. How could I have ever lived without this thing? And it's just a matter of us just doing the maintenance and taking care of things. And I think that, probably one of the biggest things that ruins bands is outside influence. People will take the main songwriter or the leader of the band and start whittling away at their integrity. And start helping them to forget what made them a good band. Sometimes the parts are interchangeable, and sometimes you do need to make changes in your lineup so that the overall health of the group stays healthy or improves. I can't tell you how many times there's been a bass player in a band that's been the problem. Or you have, in Spinal Tap, there's somebody already in the organization, You have somebody's girlfriend go out and do a Linda McCartney, start playing keyboards or something like that,
Right.
And those are the things that I think break bands up because you don't have that open line of communication with people because it's built on a premise which is not being a serious, no shit, I only have one plan, no plan B approach to this career.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're thinking like, I'm going to try and make it, well, you've already failed because you're trying. You're not doing it. You're not going to make it. You have to program yourself the same way you did with your wrestling career. Mm-hmm. You're going to do it.
Yeah, there's no option.
Right.
There's no back.
No plan B.
Right. What happens now? You mentioned that Chris is helping you guys out, Chris Adler, drum-wise. What do you do if he's on the road with Lamb of God? Are you trying to find somebody else? Or you like him so much, you will work around his schedule and act accordingly?
It's a little bit of both. We like Chris so much that we work around his schedule and the dates that he's not available. We use a young guy named Tony Loriano, who played with Nile and Dima Borger and Fear Factory. He was one of the guys that Chris had actually recommended. And I was just talking to somebody the other day, and they were laughing, calling him Calves of Iron, you know. And I do remember Tony has unrealistically giant calves. So now that he said that, I will always think of Tony with the calves.
It always
of iron.
Pisses me off, the guys that have those big calves.
Yeah.
Because it's not a muscle you can ever build.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's like building a thumb muscle.
Yeah. He said, those calves, it's just like, my God, there's big, big calves. Mm. What do you, lyrically now, I mean, Dystopia, I did not look it up because I wanted you to explain what it is. We know what a utopia is. Is it the opposite of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a place that's all foobar. You know, it's funny for us when we go into the theater and we watch movies, the ones that we usually like the most to fantasize about is, you know, the world is hanging on by a fingernail and some guy that's just like you or me saves it all. Mm-hmm. And he gets the chick and the stupid father-in-law or the bitchy mother-in-law gets punched in the chops on the way to Las Vegas to the little blue chapel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I loved Planet of the Apes as a kid, and 12 Monkeys I thought was really great in my middle age. And seeing like the new Planet of the Apes was great again. There, like Independence Day, watching, you know, Terminator, all the different versions of the future being just everything is just, like I said, foobar.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got this word that completely describes that world. If utopia is everything great in the world, dystopia is everything not great.
Did you make that up?
No, it's a real word.
Actual word.
And the funny thing, thanks, Jose. The funny thing is that, salute.
Cheers, man, salute. Now, this is official Blood of Heroes.
This is the Syrah, yeah.
Dave Mustaine brand wine.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about this in a second. Tastes good, man.
It is good.
Yeah. Is this something, we'll get back to Dystopia in a second, is this something that, is there like a vineyard that you have a part of? Where is that?
This is the last bottling of this, and there's only a couple, look at the legs on that thing. It's only got a couple more cases to go, and it's all gone. The new bottling that our family just did was called Kingmaker, and it is a Monterey, and we did one called Hook and Mouth before that, which was super Tuscan.
Where's the vineyards located at?
In Temecula, in California.
Okay,
so we were hanging and did the Symphony Interrupted thing a couple of years ago, and I was talking with my wife Pam about, you know, how do we do something to kind of have this adhesive effect between the two worlds colliding, the classical and metal world. And we thought, you know, hey, the wine would be a great way to do that because it's posh, plus my taste is very, you know, selective. And we went to this vineyard and we picked a line and we finished the recipe ourselves and made a bottling of this Cabernet Sauvignon called Symphony Interrupted. And Pam had done two pallets of it because we didn't know, you know, what it was going to be like. And I didn't want to be drinking this stuff the rest of my life if it wasn't any good. And poof, it was gone. So we knew we had stumbled onto something that was going to be fun for our family and for our legacy, for our children and our children's
children. How do you make a recipe for wine?
Well, there are certain different, you know, each grape has a different taste to it, an acidity to it. The skin is different. The pulp inside of it's different. Where it comes from, obviously, it has a lot to do with it too. The ground, the topography, the minerals, the nutrients in the ground, the temperature of the ground at night, during the day, all year long, has a lot to do with the way that the roots are, the way that the sun hits the plant, what hour of the day the sugar gets the most in the grapes and then goes back into the stem. You know what. It's almost like, you know, gorging and purging when you do yoga, how you get a good workout and then you stretch out. These grapes get this process where they're constantly in flux and growing, and you get certain grapes that are picked at certain times of the year. And the difference in the time that they have for fermentation between when they turn the grapes over and stuff like that is the difference between something having a really smooth finish like this. Mm-hmm. You know, this doesn't have that some wino just stuck his sock in my mouth kind of feeling, you know, after you've drank it. It's really, really a great tasting
wine. I'm not a big red wine fan, but this is very crisp. Mm-hmm. It doesn't leave that aftertaste that you know.
It's a brilliant finish to it. And, you know, when we set out to do this again, you know, the very first time it was kind of more of a, let's see how it is. And then the second time we were definitely, we want to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And it's all based off of my personal taste, you know, if I like it. Like when we did the coffee stuff for Net Worth Coffee, we had originally started that off and gotten really involved in working with a charity down in Tijuana with the profits. And once the orphanage down there had a water well that had broken, they needed it to be replaced. So once that was done, we basically said, okay, we're done. We've done our good, and you know, we're kind of gonna move on with our life, and this I think has been much more fun because the coffee stuff is really unique and interesting, but there's just a totally different circle of people, and the process of making this is just really fascinating.
It's interesting to me because that's kind of one of the things now is a lot of band-related alcohols. You know, Iron Maiden's Trooper Beer, and I know.
Yeah, but is it any good?
I mean, I'm not a big beer guy, but I know they sell
Trooper
a lot
was good.
Of it.
I tasted it. I thought it was good.
Right.
Yeah. I also know of another band. I won't say their name because I don't want to embarrass them, but they got into the wine business, and they had bought this wine really super cheap, and I think they ended up doing a clearance sale for $1 a bottle on the stuff.
That would be called a rot gut.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, God, I can remember back when I was hurting for money, $1 for a bottle of wine would have been, you know, a deal.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, give me two.
But we're talking about dystopia and what it means, and I know you always write lyrics based on what's kind of going on in the world, and you have a lot of political opinions and that sort of thing. Did you write the lyrics on this record based on some stuff that's going on now in the world?
Yeah, but not from the same perspective that people mistakenly think that, you know, my viewpoint of the world is, because I don't think that the world's a bad place. I think that it's a good place, and, you know, there's some bad dudes in it. And and also, you know, people think that, you know, I have certain beliefs, like I'm anti-gay. I'm not. Like, that I'm a racist. I'm not. I had a black tech for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, just crazy, crazy things that they say that they have no idea who or what I am. I think probably the saddest thing is when people start saying, you know, what political affiliation I have. You know, I, like yourself, you know, answer to a different set of angels. So while I'm here, I try and, you know, pick the lesser of two evils. So I've voted Democrat, I've voted Republican, and there's been times I've completely abstained because I just couldn't do it either way. So as far as politics and writing and stuff like that, I think it's more about, you know, what my role is here as a person. Am I going to leave a reputation, or am I going to leave character behind? You know, am I going to do something that really makes something good for somebody, or am I going to be one of those guys where they you know, it's like what that saying is, some people clap when you enter a room, and sometimes they clap when you leave. Right. I can't remember how it was.
That's close enough.
Yeah, something like that.
I think for me, I always think back to Megadeth's political stance because they always had you doing so much of the rock the vote in MTV, like 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And of course, P-Cell is very political. So you've always kind of had that vibe to the band. And that's, you know, you got to write about something. You can't write about dragons and rainbows.
You can if that's what you, if that's your gig.
Cause your deal.
We've had, and you know, he did it really well.
But that was his thing.
That was his thing. The thing with Megadeth, we've done a couple songs. Actually, we did have a song with a dragon. In Five Magics, believe it or not. So, look out. So, you know, I think that lyrically, if you challenge yourself as a writer and you don't write the same thing over and over, I mean, how many times has some of our favorite rock bands written a song about sex or, you know,
And if you're going to write about sex and it's cleverly done, cool. But if it's just, you know, action satisfaction, you're like, oh, give me a break.
Yeah, and it's usually something that isn't clever. You know, it's not something where, you know, you're listening to it and you're like, well, what does it mean? You know, like, who would have ever known Cyndi Lauper's She-Bop song was about masturbation? I never knew that.
How did we not pick that up?
Guess we're not girls. But I digress. I think that when you write lyrics, you have an important decision to make. What am I going to impart on the listener? Is it just something that's going by in passing because the music is that great, you just need something to kind of distract them a little bit? Is the music the plate and the lyrics the meal? Or is it a little bit of both? And I think that because for me, I made the terrible mistake in the beginning of writing music and then putting lyrics to it. The music's always way complicated, way more complicated than most people's music would be. When they play guitar and sing at the same time, they usually drop it down a gear during the verses.
Right.
And then make it really big during the chorus. And then during the solo section is where they'll have a really get down progressive riff or something like that, you know. And that's usually the way that it goes. A great intro, a great reintro, bridge part, something like that. And, you know, for us, though, I write the song and the song sings the song. And then it's like, okay, well, how do you rhyme with orange, you know? So
yeah, there used to be a band in Canada called Rhymes with Orange.
There was
in the mid-90s.
That's crazy.
Because nothing rhymes with orange, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing does. But I mean, and that's it's funny, you're talking about lyrics. I you'll appreciate this because I saw on Instagram when you guys went recently to Bon Scott's grave in Perth. So my son comes home and, you know, he's laughing about something. He's really into classic rock stuff. And he's telling me, Dad, I heard this song today. And it was called Big Balls.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I was like, you know what? When I was 12, I had the exact same thing. You're laughing. Hey, we've got big balls. And then, of course, he had to play it for my daughters. So that's the big song around my house is they're all laughing about big balls.
Yeah.
That lasts forever.
That's being a kid, though. That's being a young boy. You know, Pam was talking about how stoked she was that Justice was a real, you know, get down dirty, you know, scabby, messed up haired, smelly little boy, so that, you know, he grew up like a real, like a real boy, you know, going outside and, you know, getting grass stains and, you know, having fun and, you know, versus some of these kids, you know, where their parents are afraid if they go outside, they're going to, you know, get some kind of pesticide poisoning from rolling around on the grass or some crap like that.
Well, I was proud of him too because, you know, in this day and age, and music is music and every generation will have theirs, but when it's One Direction and Justin Bieber and he came home singing Big Balls, I was like, hey,
yeah, that's my boy. That's my boy. Chip off the old block.
Here's another thing I was going to bring up with you, because we were over in Europe at the same time when the attacks happened in Paris. Is that something, like, did you think that was... Well, what did you feel about that, being over in Europe at that point in time?
You know, it's really hard to answer this stuff, because part of me wants to be really defiant and say stuff, and the other part of me is very cautious because, you know, as an entourage, when we go into a city, there's so many other people whose lives are affected.
That's what I mean, right?
So you're talking not only the other three band members, but the crew members, the venue staff, and all the fans, too. You know, so part of me is like, okay, well, how do you make the most educated statement that you can possibly make to anybody trying to take away your freedom or your security? Go about your life. You know, because I believe that my time is already decided. So whether, you know, I die because somebody dropped a bologna sandwich out of a 747 and, you know, it killed me because it, you know, it halved me from skull to, you know, heel with some Oscar Mayer. I don't know.
How fitting. Mustaine dies by bologna sandwich.
That's right.
Slicing.
That's right. Cut him right in half.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking, too, because we actually were in the Netherlands when it happened. We had a gig in Paris 1 week later to the day. And, you know, a lot of people were, should we quit? And I was like, you know what? We're playing the show. I don't care if two people show up, because you can't let that stop you. It's scary, but like you said, you can't allow that to affect you to where you just stop being you.
And see, the problem is that a lot of people won't recognize that as being one of the few ways that we can truly defeat this is by going about our lives. And you know, because what is terror? They make us freeze in fear, and we stop living our lives the way that we live them. And as far as, you know, I have a little bit of some French blood in me. France to me has always been about art, theater, fashion, mm-hmm. music. And for Paris to not be able to have art and theater and fashion and music would be not only a national but almost a global atrocity.
That's what France is known for, and Paris is known for, is that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote a note down here earlier. You mentioned about your mother-in-law. Have you seen the movie I'll Be Me, Glenn Campbell?
No, but I've heard
Have you
about
heard
it.
About it?
I've heard about it, yeah.
It's amazing. I just had to bring this up just quickly because he's suffering from Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I heard really
but
bad.
He goes on tour. Mm-hmm. And people know what's going to happen. And mm-hmm. the last thing he still retains is his ability to play guitar and sing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So ingrained in his system. Mm-hmm. It's very.
He's a great player, too.
Oh, my goodness. I never knew. You know, you never think about guys like that, you know, like you mentioned Willie Nelson before and stuff, because we were such rock guys and metal mm-hmm. guys. Yeah. When you watch those guys just whip out some solos, it was incredible.
Yeah, he was one of the main go-to guys in Nashville for a very long time. And I think in L.A., too. I don't know how long. I think he did a stint doing session work in L.A., too. But I remember when I was a kid, he used to have a TV show, and you know, back then there wasn't, you know, 300 stations of mm-hmm. television to choose from. So at night when there was television programs, you know, as a family, you'd get around the boob tube and you'd watch it. And I remember just seeing him play. Of course, his hair never looked real to me, but
he was always perfectly coiffed.
His playing was unbelievable.
Yeah.
He and a guy named Roy Clark at the time, I thought was just an amazing country player.
Was that the guy that was on Hee Haw?
Yeah, Buck Owens and Roy Clark.
There's a lot of those guys that were like that, because even like Travis Tritt now, or what's the cat's name? He's on American Idol. Keith, is it Keith Urban?
Keith Urban is one. On you know, Keith was in a metal band.
Really?
I met him one time. This is a really funny story for all you Keith Urban fans. I don't know that you're listening, but the guy that had engineered our first two records, named Jeff Balding, was working on something for me, and I'd come into Nashville to come and see him, and he goes, "Hey, Dave," talks like this, right? He goes, "Man, I'm in the studio over here at Sound Kitchen, and I got this little young guy. He's Australian, and he's from a metal band, and he's going to go country." And I went, "That'll never work." And look at him now. He's a massive superstar, so...
Mm-hmm. How is that for you, I mean, doing this for so long and being such a, I mean, you know, I'll say this and you're going to say, "Oh, shut up," but being a legendary figure in the world of rock and roll.
What was that?
Rock and roll. Legendary.
Okay.
I mean, that you,
just make sure you
iconic.
That right. I won't say shut up to that.
is it, I mean, I get this now. I can't believe that I'm at this stage. But like you, I've been doing wrestling for so long that there's a lot of kids that are like, mm-hmm. "Oh my God, you're my favorite."
You're a legend, yeah.
You know, how do you feel when you get that sort of accolades?
Like a survivor, which is something really great because, you know, it's like they say in the 12-step thing where they say we're like people who have survived a shipwreck. We generally would not mix. I think there's a common thread that runs with people who are artists like us who become successful because a lot of us really are shy, but you give us the microphone and something turns on. Mm-hmm. But when the microphone isn't on, we go back to being, you know, a little bit introverted, kind of shy, goofing around, normal kind of guys. And we have our friendships with people that are normal kind of guys. And it's really difficult when you're in a room with your bros, you know, mm-hmm. and someone comes in and they want to tell you how much of a difference you've made in your life, because, you know, we all feed on that, you know, being accepted, you know, having, you know, that encouragement and stuff like that. And, you know, the second that the guy leaves the room, all your friends are going to go, "You suck. You're an asshole. How much you pay that guy?" You know, that kind
right,
of stuff.
Right. So, but yeah, but it's something to me that, like you said, Survivor, that's a good, I was going to ask this before, and I haven't asked you, just a couple more questions before we wrap up. When you guys did the first Big Four, you guys had a dinner the first night, just band dudes. Mm-hmm. How was that just being around all the other survivors?
It was very laid back, and I thought it was very enjoyable. Trujillo was out front greeting everybody when we walked in the door, which was really nice. Mm-hmm. And he hugged me, which was you know, it wasn't startling by any means. It didn't shock me or anything like that. But it was just a great way to start things. Mm-hmm. And when the night kind of rolled around to about it's time for Dave to go home time, I decided I should probably leave. And I guess those guys roared into the night, the rest of my band, bunch of crew guys, and they just had a great time. And I think that the big four thing that we did, it was really important. It was necessary for a lot of different reasons. You know, if it happens again, that would be great. If it doesn't, the people who got to see it got to see something really remarkable. Am I opposed to doing it? You know, it would have to be the right thing. I think that, you know, Megadeth is at a place right now where we're successful to a degree where we would be happy continuing to do what we do on our own. So, you know, if we're going to do another Big Four thing, I would want it to be something where we walk away as content as Metallica does from something mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not Metallica and three other dudes.
Right, right, right.
You know.
I think just and whether it happens again or not, it doesn't really matter. It happened.
It did.
And it was very monumental mm-hmm. for, you know, for rock and roll, for heavy metal, and for the fans. Fans, mm-hmm. fans, like even this Guns N' Roses quasi-reunion, whatever it is, it's people like that stuff. They enjoy the feeling of like, they did it. This yeah. is great, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, people got what they wanted to see, and mm-hmm. you can always have that memory, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, I wish Adler was doing it. I just think that, you know, just for just cherry on top of the sundae,
mm-hmm.
it you know, because he's not gone. He's not deceased.
No, I agree.
And I think that, I don't know if Izzy's doing it or not, but if Slash and Axl and Duff are going to be doing this, go all the way, boys. I love Slash. He's one of my favorite guitar players and just a wonderful person. I'm sure you probably know him
really
well, too. Yeah.
And I love the concept that you guys actually jammed together and wrote some tunes together at some point.
Yeah, he was supposed to be joining Megadeth. And you know,
really?
Well, Ellison was hammering him for a while. I lived with Dave and he would come over and the three of us would we would take vitamins at night.
Yes. almonds.
Yes. So we had a lot of times where we would, you know, hang out and joke around and stuff. And I had no idea, but Ellison had been talking to him, you know, the whole time about joining Megadeth. He was really close, too.
Really?
This is before Marty came in, yeah.
So about 89 or so? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Now, Slash had a really great blues mm-hmm. flair, which I think probably would have worked really well in Megadeth, but that's kind of my shtick, the pentatonic scale stuff. So I don't know how well that would have worked, having two predominantly blues players playing in a band. It would probably be a little bit more like Thin Lizzy
mm-hmm.
than like how Megadeth is right now.
Want the shredder and you're the pentatonic bluesy guy. Not that you can't shred too.
No, yeah, and I understand. Thank you for that. I think that the exotic scales, it's kind of like, you know, peanut butter to the jelly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they complement each other. The fire, the ice, the love, the hate, you know, good, the bad, whatever. Mm-hmm.
I think is this an urban myth too? Is it true that you asked Dime to join at one point?
Did.
That's pretty crazy, too.
Yeah, and it was very close to being done, too. And to think if I would have made his phone call one phone call sooner, it would have been Daryl and Vinnie Paul in Megadeth.
Wow.
Here's what happened. So I call Nick Menza and I hire him. I call up Daryl and I said, hey, man, I want you to join my band. He goes, can I bring my brother? It's like, I don't care. Who's your brother? And he goes, my brother plays drums. And I said, well, we just hired a drummer. Well, I ain't coming. I was like, oh, okay. And that was basically the whole conversation. Yeah. And if I didn't have Nick Manzi at the band and he would have said, can I bring my brother? And I would have said, sure.
Yeah, give it a try.
Yeah. Then, you know what? Who knows what would have happened?
Yeah.
You know.
Would you think of him as a player? I mean, obviously.
I thought he was really, really talented. I think that a lot of people, they kind of misused the Wang Bar a lot. I think Daryl used it properly. And I think he had some really mind-blowing speed and technique. His picking was very clean. I think that he swept and arpeggiated very well. That's not something I do very well. I don't sweep at all, and I don't arpeggiate very well. So he had a lot of things that I wish I could do better.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the tone he had was very interesting, too, because he used a very unorthodox metal head. So he used Randalls, which aren't really known mm-hmm. for being metal.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah. mentioned his name earlier. I just wanted to ask quickly about Gar Samuelson. Seems kind of like one of the forgotten guys in the history of metal, as far as you mentioned how great of a drummer he was. Do you feel that? Do you think that he was one of your favorite drummers you've ever played with?
Favorite I've ever played with. Gar was a great person. It was hard to play with him.
In what way?
Runaway. We didn't play to a click at the time, and there was so much partying going on that, you know, it was kind of like you see the clowns in the circus with the wheels that are shaped like eggs instead of circles. It was faster and slower yeah. and faster and slower yeah, yeah. and faster, you know, and I love how he played. It just sometimes the songs would be so mind-numbingly fast that they just, you know, and people thought that's how we normally played, and it's just because, you know, somebody met us and at the wrong time did some right. the wrong stuff to the wrong vitamins. Person. So... But I loved Gar. I think that, you know, when people ask me if I have any regrets, one of my main regrets is not saying goodbye to him because, you know, we didn't talk much before he passed away. He was living in Florida. I lived in L.A. And, you know, not that we didn't have a friendship because, you know, we'd seen each other several times after, you know, we'd parted ways. But, you know, it's just sad when somebody that you know, that you love and you care about, they're just gone, you know.
And casualties of rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah, it's been so many lately.
Yeah, I know. Within 2 weeks. Dystopia is the record, and it's hard to always answer this. Do you have a track that stands out for you?
I have two. I like The Threat Is Real.
I think
Threat Is Real has a really cool solo breakdown because it's a weird time signature again.
You know what I love about that song, too, is your voice, just the way you sing with that snare. You're like, can't close the door. Like, just how you say door, I like it. Yeah, just grunt. You have a really good habit of hitting certain words, and it just sounds really like it just...
I had my puppy chow that morning. I was ready to go.
Yeah, it's good, man.
Thanks. The other song that I like is Poisonous Shadows, I think, because it's so different from, you know, I mean, it totally has the character that embodies everything that's Megadeth, you know, fast riffing, heavy drums, a lot of melody and stuff like that, but the story that it takes the listener on, the journey is much different than anything we've ever done before, because it starts off one way, it builds, and it crescendos in the middle, and then it goes back into the same building concept where it just drops off, and you have this really dark, almost Hitchcockian approach towards the end of the song with this Chopin-esque piano part at the end, where, you know, you've seen the main character get attacked and the antagonist is like all of a sudden playing the piano. It's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah,
you know, really, really unexpected. And that was one of the other things that I loved about your friend Kiko, you know, how talented he was, because he just got on the piano and just played it like nobody's business. Just play it. It was a funny thing. We were in Japan, and I went into his room for some reason. I look on his bed, and I see this long silver tube, and I'm like, oh, my God, is that a flute? He's in there shredding on a flute. And funny thing was, right before we did the record, we were looking at cover songs to cover, and, you know, of course, we did Foreign Policy by Fear and Melt the Ice Away by Budgie, but one of the songs we talked about doing was some Jethro Tull stuff. Like,
oh yeah,
you know, Aqualung is a great song, but we both Chris Adler's band and my band were managed by this guy named Larry. I'll leave his last name off, but he had really bad cross eyes, and we were gonna, instead of doing Cross-eyed Mary, we were gonna call it Cross-eyed Larry. I don't know that I would have gotten any publishing off that for changing the lyrics or anything like that, but it certainly would have made me feel a hell of a lot better.
Great lineup, and it's a great new record, and it's great talking to you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you, bro.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks to Dave Mustaine. Great guy. Always been a treat to me, and I'm not kidding when I say this. The new Megadeth album, Dystopia, is one of my favorites. It's probably my favorite Megadeth record since Rust in Peace. The opening track, The Threat Is Real, Dystopia itself, Fatal Illusion, Bullet to the Brain. So much riffage Maximus, as I said, to Slash. And the solos are crazy. I love the new lineup. Kiko Loureiro from Angra, huge fan of his for years. Lamb of God, Chris Adler on the drums. He's a monster.
As you heard Dave said, Chris is not in Megadeth per se. He's just helping them out. He's still in Lamb of God, but hopefully he can play as many shows with Megadeth as possible. Megadeth's tour starts February 20 in Dallas, Texas, and Chris will do as many shows as he can. Kika will be there for all of them. Same with Ellefson. But like I said, do yourself a favor and buy Dystopia. Okay, you can get it on Amazon. Use the TIG Amazon links. So you can support Megadeth and this show in one fell swoop. All right, just go to podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button at the top right-hand corner of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for the USA, the UK, the Canada. Every time you use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage of this show to help us cover production costs. You can buy just about anything you want on Amazon. Use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links. They won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees or extra challenges. Just go to podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All my sponsors are on there as well, so you have easy access to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and the new DDP Yoga Now app to betdsi.com and to Solar World. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines. They're coming up next. I want you to stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs. And on Friday, we got the special, much-anticipated crew cast. And what the crew cast is, it's Dolph Ziggler and Bubba Ray Dudley talking about their favorite band, Motley Crue. Motley Crue, RIP, they're done. They've rolled up the carpets. But Dolph and Bubba are going to be telling us all about their Motley Crue experiences and feelings. It's the Crew Cast, the first ever Crew Cast this Friday. So we'll see you then. Yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha F335 acoustic guitar, just $99. Or get a Luna Soprano ukulele, only $49. Plus the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. Lessons for the beginner on your list. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.
Trump's victory. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute.
It's always a lot of fun when you win. If you work hard and lose, that's not acceptable.
At the White House, President Trump welcomed Republicans from the House and the Senate who passed a bill overhauling the tax code. The president says the middle class will be seeing the effects of this bill very soon.
The typical family of four earning $75,000 will see an income tax cut of more than $2,000. They're going to have $2,000, and that's, in my opinion, going to be less than the average. You're going to have a lot more than that.
The tax overhaul bill also includes a corporate tax cut.
We have companies pouring back into our country, and that means jobs, and it means really the formation of new, young, beautiful, strong companies.
Democrats have criticized the tax package as a giveaway to corporations and the rich. The tax cuts for businesses are permanent under this tax bill, but reductions for individuals and families will expire after a decade. I'm Ed Donahue.